Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Some things change, but the best things stay just the way they are. It's Wednesday, it's noon, and the Dakota Political Junkies are with us. The Junkies are a rotating panel of some of the most experienced and insightful political journalists in the state. Today, we welcome Roger Whittle, managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks. It's nice to be the first In the Moment guest.
And also with us, Dakota political junkie Denise Ross. Denise from Rapid City, thanks for being here as well.
Oh, thank you. And I'm just loving the new show. I just let you know that.
Thank you.
I was going to send an email, but I thought I'd tell you right on the air.
Thanks. And we couldn't do it without the junkies at noon on Wednesday. So let's get started because we have so much to talk about. I'm sure we won't get to it all. I want to get to initiated Measure 22 and Ethics Commission, especially as it relates to the national conversation right now. But let's start with IM21 because that's been making daily news, at least on the in Sioux Falls for sure. In the Argus Leader, there's something almost every day. Chuck Brennan, Dollar Loan Center, 400 jobs lost because of the payday lending measure, he says. Things are starting to shut down. Let's talk about IM21 and the impact of that. Roger, do you want to kick us off with what we're seeing?
Well, I think we're seeing what everybody expected to see, that these short-term loan companies are closing. It's happening in Watertown, it's happening in Sioux Falls, and I'm assuming it's happening across the state. The owners of these businesses were saying all along that there's no way they can survive under these new rules. It was a little bit unfair to them. The rules say now 36 or 35% interest is what you charge, and that sounds like a lot, but when you're dealing with short-term loans, you know, the 35% is an annual rate. And when you shrink that down to a two-week period, whatever these loan companies are requesting, there's just not enough money there to keep these places in business. So they're closing. I don't think anyone should be surprised by that.
Denise, are you seeing the impact of that in Rapid City as well?
Yeah, and it's not getting the headlines out here that it's getting in Sioux Falls, but I think voters knew that they understood that was going to be the effect. This is an industry that has not been popular, and for over a decade, for sure. Different politicians in the South Dakota legislature and even Congress was successful in getting something passed to protect young military families against what they viewed as predatory lending, and that's what this particular measure was modeled after. And so I think voters understood that, and I think they were okay with the industry going away, that there may be some unforeseen consequences. And if you read, I read the Argus Leader coverage of an interview with the gentleman that owns Dollar Loan Center and the Badlands Pond and the Speedway and the Rock and Roll Academy, and he's just basically shutting everything down, it sounds like, except for a few, just a few things. But he's still got a thriving business in other states, and so one could argue that if he did want to continue to support his hometown, he has the means to do so. But I guess he's just saying if we're not here as the short-term payday lender, we're not here, and that's his choice as a private businessman. But I think you have to read between the lines and see that he's making some choices that I think you could argue he could make different choices if he wanted to.
And Denise is talking about Chuck Brennan, who has a complicated relationship with his hometown as his businesses have sort of done, different things in the community and lots of conversations about that. He also mentioned the tax impact to the state. Roger, do you think that's fair? Do you think we're going to see a tax impact from initiated Measure 21 that was not anticipated?
I thought he made a lot of good points. I don't think this was one of them. The people that are working in these places, they're going to get other jobs, and so that that revenue will keep coming into the state. With how low our unemployment is in the state, I don't think those people have any trouble finding work again very soon. So, in that regard, I think he was a little off base, but. In other things, I kind of agreed with him. You look at the popularity of these businesses; they were everywhere. I mean, in Watertown, it seems they shouldn't drive three or four blocks without seeing one. obviously there was a need for these businesses or they wouldn't have stayed open. So I'm curious to see what the result is going to be of these places closing and what the people who use them are going to do now.
Denise, I want to make sure that we also talk about Initiated Measure 22 before we run out of time, and that's the voter-approved sort of ethics and campaign finance reform overhaul, an injunction against it now. We just heard a news story from Lee Strubinger talking to Secretary of State from South Dakota, Chantel Krebs, saying she supports an ethics commission. Governor Dugard, in his final 2 years, and now this is a pretty big thing sitting on his desk. What are your initial thoughts about the Ethics Commission and IM 22 as it relates to South Dakota?
Well, I think it's going to be the issue that dominates the legislative session. We shall see. There's always something that comes up that nobody saw coming, but right now this looks kind of like the big one. There's a couple observations within the Republican Party, which absolutely dominates South Dakota politics. You're seeing a split. You've got now Attorney General and gubernatorial candidate Marty Jackley supporting this and duty-bound to legally defend it in court. But I think he's also made a strategic decision as a candidate to support these ethics reforms. When you look at the EB-5 program and the Gear Up program and what he's done with those, you can see that he's, you know, putting his chips out that he's going to be on the side of reform. Now you see Secretary of State Chantel Krebs on that side of the line.
Right.
And then you have the governor, and I'm not exactly sure how many Republican legislators, but certainly the leaders and some marquee names like Mark Mickelson, they seem infuriated. They seem, you know, the reporting uses the words anger and ire and that they would have an ethics commission installed. And then you hear a man like Governor Dugard, who by all accounts is a thoughtful, respectful, you know, politician. He's not one of these firebrands who's out there picking fights with people. And he comes out and he says that he doesn't think the voters understood what they were voting on. You know, these are the same voters who elected him, who elected the legislature. And, you know, 10 years ago, it would have been unheard of for the legislature to try and reverse something that the voters had just passed. Now we're here the second year in a row. They did the minimum wage thing, which then got reversed again by the voters to show, yes, we do understand what we're doing, and this is what we meant to do. And yes, it was a complicated package, but the legislators that are speaking out and the governor are saying, you know, that this public financing of campaigns, well, voters would have never supported that. Well, that was pretty much the centerpiece of their campaign against this. So the information was out there. I think the voters, and I was surprised. I didn't think the voters would ever go for that. But in fact, they did. So either they put that aside and said these other reforms are more important to us, or they actually like this idea of public campaign finance. I'm just not sure.
Right. What about the constitutional challenge to it, Denise? I mean, it was challenged in court. There's an injunction. What about this, the very notion that at its core it's not constitutional and needs to be redone?
Yeah. My best understanding of that is that they found this provision that says it has to be overseen by a constitutional officer, which would be one of these statewide elected officials like the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, State Auditor, etc. If that were truly the rub here, I think you would see a piece of legislation coming forward like Secretary of State Krebs is offering to put that in place rather than a court battle to repeal the whole thing. I think if that were really the problem, which we didn't hear a word about that during the campaign, if that were truly the issue, then I think you would see a fix coming rather than an effort to just scrap the whole thing.
Roger, you have some thoughts on what needs to be done next for IM-22?
Well,
you've got all the answers, don't you?
I have no answers. I have interesting observations, though,
yeah.
Let's hope. I think it's fascinating that the politicians, the Republicans, are saying the voters didn't know what they passed. I think that's a dangerous road to go down for anybody to be critical of the voters. These are actually the same people who voted for them. So it's kind of surprising that that's the tack they're taking. I think their safest thing to do is to go through the courts and say it's unconstitutional the way it is, and then let those chips fall where they may. But to kind of put it on the voters as doing something stupid is just not a very wise move, I don't think.
Roger, at this point, this session, these lawmakers almost have to come out with something that that voters feel that, that that meets the voters' intent, though. I mean, they can't just kick it back and ignore it.
Right. I think that's true. And I think this is going to be a really interesting legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to be a big issue. But remember, last session there were some cracks developing in our Republican majority where there were infighting and sides being taken. And if that all carries over into this session, it's going to be very interesting. I was talking to some member of the legislature recently. I can't remember who it was, but he was saying that the Democrats, even though they have a very small, their smallest majority in quite a while, are going to be playing a key role because of that split in the Republican Party, that it's going to be the Democrats mm-hmm. who are going to be being counted on to pass legislation one way or the other. I thought that was just such an interesting comment.
We're just getting started with this conversation, but we're out of time, so we're going to bump it to next week and keep having it. All kinds of stuff will come up this session. You're listening to Roger Whittle, Managing Editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Denise Ross, thanks so much for being here as well. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you.
After the break, we talk climate trends and crop production with Dr. Elwin Taylor. You're listening to In the Moment, SDPB Radio. And welcome back to In the Moment. With me in the studios in Vermilion now, we have Dr. Elwin Taylor. He's a professor and Iowa State University Extension climatologist. He spoke this morning at the Dakota Farm Show in the Dakota Dome in Vermilion. The topic was climate trends and crop production. He's got dozens of honors to his name here, including Iowa Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award and more. But let's go ahead and say welcome, Dr. Taylor. Thanks for being here with us today.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. It's been a wonderful day so far.
And how was your talk well attended over there at the Dakota Dome? Was there lots of interest in the topic of climate and crop production?
Well, I wasn't disappointed with the group, and I don't think anyone was, but I noticed there were about 10 empty seats, so that's not bad out of 200.
That is a pretty big crowd today. So give us some of, what are people wanting to hear? What are some of their big questions about what they have to look forward to as farmers and producers in the state?
Well, of course, farming is going to always be our major industry in the world. It's the oldest industry, the largest industry, and I might add the most important industry that we've got. So, all in all, agriculture's here to stay. The wealth of nations depends on it. Well, farmers would like to think that everyone recognizes that, but not everyone does. Nevertheless, agriculture is here and it's doing well. The farmers sometimes don't have things as convenient as they would like it. Right now, the beef producers are saying, we paid a lot to get these cattle to feed, and we're not getting much for them when we sell them. Well, there's ups and downs. And that's some of the things we talk about, is managing the risks that go along with ups and downs in the world of production and consumption. The consumption's always there, but the production varies a great deal, and that can have a big impact on the local economy as well as the individual farmer.
We could talk a long time just about the character of dealing with what kind of personalities it takes and the resilience of living through that up and down and planning for it. But I want to make sure that we address this notion of what the climate is doing and what sort of information were you able to bring to them that's useful to them this year and this season?
Well, we've got a couple of things that we looked at carefully, and of course I always like to take questions before I start to talk so that everyone knows I'm talking about what they are interested in. And the first question is, tell us about what's going on in this world of climate change and all the radicals that we're hearing from and the truths and the untruths and the misconceptions and the correct conceptions. So that's how we started off today, was talking about what's going on in the world of climate, especially as it affects agriculture.
And what was your message for them? Where should they listen when there's so much news that some of it does feel extreme to them and some of it they can see when they walk into their fields too? So where do you get your information?
The first thing that we know about our changing climate is that it was more than 50 years ago, about 52 years ago now, that the president's science advisor went in to see President Lyndon Johnson and said, I've got two concerns that you would like to hear about, President. One, we have polluted the world's atmosphere with nuclear particles from our atmospheric testing, mostly of bombs. And second, the carbon dioxide that's been measured is increasing, and we can tell that's because we're burning fossils for fuel at a rate faster than the Earth creates new fossils. And if we don't want to go down in history as the nation that changed the composition of the atmosphere, both for nuclear waste material and the composition for carbon dioxide, we need to do something about it. Well, President Johnson called a special session of Congress and said, let's not let that be our heritage. Do something about it. It's been a miracle. So in that 50 years, what have we done? The first thing they did was say, well, if we're using more energy than the Earth can handle, we need to cut back. We'll be conservative. If you'll double the insulation in your attic, you can deduct the cost from your taxes. Mm-hmm. So we did. And so many other things, including the car manufacturers doubling the miles per gallon we get on our gasoline. This all helped. Mm-hmm. Not enough, but it helped. Then the next thing they have was we need to substitute something for all the fossil fuel we're consuming because we want to keep our energy levels. That's energy feeds us. And so what will we use? Well, it can't be fossils. That's what we're using at too great of a rate. It'll have to be renewable energy. The wind and so many things renewable are fine, but we've got to have a liquid fuel. There comes the U.S. farmer. The U.S. farmer is ethanol. For the most part now.
Yeah.
Really, the existing solution to the world's energy, let's say, conundrum, if that would be a proper word, I suspect, in this case. And we can solve this problem with the renewable energy from agriculture, which can be completely produced without using any fossil energy. Well, we're not doing that now. The nitrogen we put on the fields comes from natural gas. But we can make it from the windmills during the time of day that they're making electricity that can't be used. The whole solution is there. That's how we began today.
And the whole solution is in agriculture, in your mind?
Well, agriculture we can't do without, either
right.
for food for the world or for correction of this problem that we've got with human impact on climate factors.
My guest is Dr. Elwin Taylor. He's a climatologist at Iowa State University. You sound hopeful, and many times we have conversations about climate change. The tone is not hopeful. Why are you are you optimistic about solutions existing that we can make an impact?
Well, since we can see and really have proven that we've got what it takes to do it. We know just what it would cost to replace enough of the fossil fuel use with renewable fuel. We know what that would cost in acres of land, in cost of food, because we've done it before. Mm-hmm. Those of us that are as old as I am can remember when farms were pretty much run by renewable fuel, in our case, horses. And it took right. one-third of our land to feed the horses. That was to power our farm equipment. That's still what it will take, is about one-third of the cropland. Can we do that and still feed the world? We can. And so, yes, I am optimistic. We've done it before. We know what it takes. We know what it takes to solve the world's problem, the shifting of climate caused by excessive use of fossil fuel. And the answers are there. There's some politics to get through.
Mm-hmm. That's my next question.
The science is in place and the technology is in place.
All right. So what are some of the policies and politics that we need? We're changing administration. We're going to have a President Donald Trump. We have a Republican Congress nationwide. What are some of the things those folks need to understand and we need them to listen to at this point?
Well, right now we're to the point with renewable fuels such as ethanol, that just leave it alone and it will do its job. It doesn't need any federal subsidy or any federal programs. Just don't fight it. Ethanol is less expensive to produce than gasoline. Well, that scares a large industry and a large employment area. We can't just drop all of that. And so that is a very legitimate concern. But as long as it doesn't happen overnight, then that can be adjusted for as we move from one industry to the other. After all, the fuel industry is the fuel industry, whether it's coming from oil wells and coal mines or whether it's coming from fields. Mm-hmm. And most of the employees would still have basically the same job.
What else needs to, is there an environmental impact to ethanol that we need to be concerned about?
Not an unavoidable one in the production of ethanol. It doesn't take, people say it takes a lot of water. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't take as much water to make corn into ethanol as it did to make corn out of the corn seed for irrigating the crop. It isn't out of control compared to other industries. The answers aren't insurmountable compared to the problems. It is, they are all there. All we need to do is accept them.
And what kind of follow-up questions did you get from folks today? Were they encouraged by the science that you're bringing them and encouraged by your message, or did they have more doubts and questions?
Well, that's about for the end of talking about climate as far as the world goes. The next one is climate as far as the farm goes. Yeah. Of course, climate controls how much yield there's going to be for the state, for the nation, for the individual farmer. That was the rest of our discussion.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope you were there in Vermilion for the Dakota Farm Show. You can find more information about that at dakotafarmshow.com. Elwin Taylor is a professor and extension climatologist at Iowa State University. He was a featured speaker over there. Are you heading back over there now?
No, I'm headed back to Iowa.
You're headed back to
Next
Iowa.
Next talk is in Burlington, Iowa.
We thank you so much for your time, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Wonderful to get acquainted. I wish everyone a very good new year.
Come back soon. After the break, U.S. Representative Kristi Noem is with us. You're in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. U.S. Representative Kristi Noem was sworn in this week as the 115th Congress gets underway. She serves on the influential House Ways and Means Committee, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about tax reform, health care reform, and early moves by congressional Republicans to rein in regulations that affect us all. Representative Noem, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, absolutely, Lori. Thank you for having me on.
We have some listener questions in our queue, but I want to start out with this late December meeting that you had. You went back to Washington to sit down with the House Ways and Means Committee. 23 people on this committee, is that right?
Well, there's more people on the committee, but to the Republicans number that many. And not all of them were able to make these special meetings that we had at the end of December. The House and Senate were out of session and home for the holidays, but a few members from the committee came back to Washington, D.C. to work on specific items such as tax reform and health care reform. Those are two things that the Trump administration has told us that they wanted to do as soon as possible in the new year, and they were hoping that we would have some legislative ideas for them. Our committee has jurisdiction over those areas, and so we had obviously been working on this already for a couple of years, but wanted to nail down a few specific priorities and be able to give the administration the kind of feedback they were looking for so that we could hit the ground running.
Can you give us an idea of what the tone of those meetings were? Were they pretty intense? Were they enthusiastic? Give us an idea of what the mood was around the table.
They were quite intense because a lot of times, with President Obama in the White House, as Republicans, we would talk about things, but the reality that we would get to do them or that the president would sign our bills was pretty slim. But now we have a president that specifically came to us and to our committee and said, hey, give me what you would like to have done as far as health care reform. Give me what you would like to see as far as tax care or tax reform. And for us, so then it's suddenly reality. So they were very long days sitting in a room talking about specifics, literally hundreds of different points. We wanted to focus on a tax reform that was much simpler. We want the average American to be able to pay their taxes on a postcard. We wanted, if there's one thing the American people have told us, is that it's too complicated. They don't believe that the tax code is fair and that the IRS is unaccountable. And so in our bills that we're recommending is lowering rates for everyone, making it much more simple, encouraging things such as savings and retirement and health care and education. But other than that, exemptions and provisions and special deals for people that have been built in for decades are just gone. And I think that's why it's really exciting, is because we're following through on exactly what we have heard from people at home is that we need to do, and we actually have an opportunity to make it law. Now, when it came to health care, we just got hundreds of stories of people who are in a worse position today under Obamacare than they've ever been before.
How so? Because of the cost of it?
The cost of it has dramatically increased. Everyone has seen the huge increases in insurance policy premiums. A few more people were covered under Obamacare policies, but like in South Dakota, and some of those insurance companies couldn't afford to keep those policies out there and have pulled out of the exchanges. For instance, we have 8,000 people who did receive individual insurance policies in South Dakota under Obamacare that now they're not going to have because it was too expensive for the company to maintain that kind of a policy there. So, you know, it's people that had access no longer have it. People who wanted to stay with their doctor were not able to do that because the plans didn't allow them to. And many of those individuals who were forced to get policies found that they were simply unaffordable. So we were putting together a health care reform package that put people back in control of their health care plans. Let them pick a plan that works for them and their family, take the mandates out of it, but give them encouraging reasons to have health care and to do what we can to cover those who have pre-existing conditions and use risk pools and health savings accounts and allow them to be much more available to people so that we could get those who are needy or who have pre-existing conditions taken care of throughout the process.
So yesterday we talked with Senator Mike Rounds, and he kind of laid out some of the procedural things that were going, making their way now. We got a lot of questions and people who were just sort of wondering what happens next. And a call from a listener here that says, this is just an example of the sort of things people are wondering. Governor Dugard supported Medicaid expansion because it would have a net positive economic effect for South Dakota, make it possible for many low-income, uninsured South Dakotans to receive medical care. How do you propose to ensure these South Dakotans still get the care that they need? So we were hearing a lot of, well, what happens next, and are people going to get kicked off? They know Affordable Health Care Act wasn't perfect, but they have some concerns about those low-income South Dakotans getting the medical care that they need. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think anyone who's on Medicaid in South Dakota will have to worry about losing that coverage. That's not in jeopardy today. We do believe Medicaid needs to have some reforms. One of those that I have put forward is that Medicaid should be a last payer. That when, for instance, in South Dakota, a lot of our Native Americans, qualify for Indian Health Service care. But instead, Medicaid ended up picking up the bill. I would prefer the Indian Health Services pay that bill before it comes out of our Medicaid dollars. I would prefer that the states be able to design their own Medicaid programs to meet their population needs. Some states have a lot more elderly people on Medicaid. Other states have more children. And even the demographics of what that population looks like can be extremely different. If you talk about Florida, which is a retirement-centered state generally, and a state like South Dakota where we have a lot of children on the program. So those states need the flexibility to design a program that works best for them, and I think it'll be much more efficient and cover more people if that's allowed. That's one of the freedoms that Obamacare just didn't allow. It dictated everything from Washington, D.C., and what this administration ended up doing throughout its term was granting waivers to different states and working one-on-one to solve problems. We just really believe that the people closest to those families can help design a program that works best for them.
So how long is it going to take?
Well, you know, the biggest problem we have right now is we want to repeal Obamacare and the mandates that go with it, but we don't want to leave anybody hanging without insurance. So we're going to have a transition period in there, and there has to be kind of what we're referring to as an off-ramp, you know, a period of years to where people, our goal is not to hurt anybody, to keep people on health care, to take care of them through the process while we're putting some replacements back in the law that gives them more control, helps them pick their doctors, drives down the costs, puts more competition in the insurance industry, some reforms that have to happen. So that transition is what we're working on, seeing where we want to go, but knowing that it can't help it happen within a 24-hour period, or you will end up with some consequences that won't be good for some Americans.
Are you optimistic that changes will be seen, you know, in the next 2 years, let's say?
Definitely. I am. I know that the Senate has a little bit of a different environment than the House. They've got tighter margins over there, and they've got a lot more procedural hurdles than we necessarily do in the House. So I think that the reality is the Senate will probably dictate the pace of what we can do. We can move quickly here in the House. We operate by simple majority on a lot of things, and that's just not true over there.
Right.
But, you know, I was told today when Vice President-elect Pence was with the Republicans here on the House side that even Inauguration Day, the new president wants to go and immediately get to work that day on repealing some of these executive orders that have been in place under the last administration. He wants to show that we're working and we're going to work right away to help as many people as possible, and that they have been actively asking us, how quickly can you get legislation to us to sign?
And what's the answer? How quickly, Representative Kristi Noem, can you get legislation through there ready to sign? That's not necessarily a small task, but yet you've had some time to sort of get ready for this day.
We have. We've had several bills that we've passed through the House and Senate the last Congresses that the president has vetoed.
Yeah.
One of them that did not get signed into law was called the RAINS Act, and it dealt with regulations. It just said that if an agency or department put forward a regulation that had an economic impact of over $100 million a year in the country, that it had to come to Congress for a vote first. We passed that through the House, I think, every year since I've been here, but it's never been signed into law. So that one is one that we're doing this year to try to stop this excessive over-regulation we see from the federal government. The president will sign that, and what that does is it's just a check and balance to regulations. It says these agencies and departments can't just randomly put out a regulation that changes our way of life without some check and balance from Congress. And Congress is elected by the people of this country. Bureaucrats aren't. And so we truly do believe that when we're making decisions, we talk to the people, we hear from them, and on these regulations, we'll get the kind of feedback that we need to make good decisions to be that balance that needs to happen.
My guest is U.S. Representative Kristi Noem, and we're going to get back to that RAINS Act and dig a little deeper into that. But first, if you have a question for Representative Noem, you can give us an email in the moment at sdpb.org, or you can send us a text. That number is 605-956-7372. That's 956-SDPB. PB. And Representative Noem, one of the questions we got yesterday for U.S. Senator Mike Rounds, we didn't get to bring it up to him. I'm wondering if he'll take a crack at it. It's important to this listener to know about the cannabis in the Controlled Substance Act. And so the question is actually, when is Congress going to correct the misclassification of cannabis in the Controlled Substance Act? And I'm just wondering what your take is on that question and how you might answer it.
You know, we just haven't had that debate on the House side for a long time. And most of us, when it comes to this issue, you know, believe that that's something the states are dealing with or are at least discussing. And so I can't really say that's at the top of our agenda. I wish I had a better answer for this listener, but it's certainly not something that we're actively working on today.
Do you see it coming with Jeff Sessions coming in? That's been a big story, and certainly there's been, it's not something that's high on the state legislative list either, but it certainly spread across the country as a conversation during the last election. Do you see it coming up then?
Possibly, but it would be interesting. I would think most of his connections, it would have to go through the Senate before it would come to us. We just haven't in the last at least 3 months talked about that issue, even in any meetings that I've been in. So I have not heard about that being discussed as an agenda that we'll do in 2017.
Interesting. Let's go back to this RAINS Act, because I'm wondering if you can help me understand. We talk about regulations and sort of deregulation. It seems very vague to me. And I'm wondering if you can give me some specifics of really how, what is the direct impact of regulations on the average family? Break it down for me.
Well, for instance, the waters of the U.S. regulation, that is having a huge impact on our country. In fact, it's a regulation that came out from the EPA that gave them jurisdiction over virtually every acre of land in the country by saying that they controlled any drop of water that might someday end up in a navigable water. They changed a definition that broadened their authority far beyond what the EPA was ever supposed to have. And they just did it through the regulatory environment. So something like that, that is so far-reaching and would have hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of economic impact on individuals, on families, on farms, on ranches, on businesses, would have to come to Congress and be, there'd have to be hearings, there'd have to be debates, and then there'd have to be a vote before that could ever be put into place. Today, right now, these agencies can just make a regulation, have a comment period, and then implement the final rule. So that the process would change dramatically and make sure that it was an open process before that could happen. You know, and there's over 500 of these major regulations that happened under President Obama. You know, so it's significant, the amount of regulatory burden that was put in on families and businesses. And people ask, well, how does the waters of the U.S. regulation impact people? Well, for them, if they were going to go out and clean out a ditch, or if they had flooding coming into their foundation on their home, they would not be able to divert that water and do anything to maintain a ditch on their property without getting an EPA permit. And then if they did do any activities such as that, they would be without an EPA permit, they could face fines into the tens of thousands of dollars per day they were in violation. Mm. So that's the economic impact that hits families and businesses that would be so devastating.
We had a conversation yesterday with the historian John Lauck, who was talking about Donald Trump in the Midwest and sort of this disconnect culturally between urban and rural. And I'm wondering if you see that as you represent South Dakota in Washington. Do you find that there is a disconnect between people just not understanding, you know, in Washington, sort of what the impact of, you know, cleaning out a ditch with water in it, for example, might be? Do some of those things just have to be explained?
Well, absolutely. That one, everybody certainly understands the impact of waters of the U.S. because it would have impacted every contractor. You know, everybody who worked on a home lot building a home would be responsible for if they got a 2-inch rainfall on that lot and imported any water, would be in violation of that waters of the U.S. regulation. So the realtors got really active on it. The chamber got active on it. So that one was pretty widespread among all groups. But what I have found in D.C. is that there's very few people who understand rural America anymore. Here in the House side, there's 34 of us in the House that come from ag and rural districts that have been farmers and ranchers or tied to the industry in the past out of 435 members. So we have to work a lot harder to make sure that those other members understand why something is important to our constituents and to our states and districts and why we need things. It's one of the reasons that it's so important I'm on the Ways and Means Committee, because that committee needed a voice there to talk about how tax policy impacts agriculture different, how health care needs to be delivered in very remote and rural areas. A lot of those folks on that committee represent very urban areas and large cities, and so they don't know what it's like for a family to have to drive 3 hours just to find a clinic, much less a hospital. So that's the kind of education that needs to happen to a lot of members of Congress to make sure that we have policies that work for everybody in America, not just those large urban populations.
So in my mind, I have this moment where you just sort of slowly raise your hand and you say, yes, but in South Dakota.
No, I don't. I wish I was that diplomatic. I tend to be sitting on the edge of my chair, you know, just waiting for somebody to take a breath so I can say, you know, that doesn't work. That doesn't work for me. Let me tell you the story about this you know, small town that, you know, and that doesn't have a clinic, and they have to drive 60 miles to even find a PA, much less their doctor, and specialty doctors are 2 hours away, and or that you can't, you know, you can't get rid of critical access hospitals, or I won't have any hospitals in 90% of my state. I will only have a hospital on each side of the state. So those are things that, you know, I have to argue and debate for constantly.
Yeah.
Because they say, you know, why do we need this provision anymore? We can use, eliminate that, take the dollars out of it and put it into something else. And I'll say, no, that's intended to keep things workable in areas where access is extremely limited and we have to provide for all people, not just for where there's the most people.
Do you feel heard?
Do I feel? Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. I do. That happened in one of our tax reform discussions when they talked about a policy, and I explained the impact it had on South Dakota, and everybody went, oh, okay, well, we're going to have to revisit it. And then we that was part of the discussion we had at the end of the year, and we came up with a solution that worked well, and it worked well for agriculture as well as other industries. You know, so I definitely do feel that if I wasn't in the room, we would have policies that would not work for South Dakota. And so I'm very grateful I've had the chance to sit there and make those changes and recommendations.
Our guest today is U.S. Representative Kristi Noem. If you have a question for her, you can send us a text right now, 956-SDPB. And Representative Noem, we have a question from Spearfish about Spearfish Canyon State Park, wondering what your take on it is. Is it necessary? I'll just read what they say here. Is the proposed land swap really of fair and equal value? Does the state federal government even have the right to proceed, because Homestake originally indicated that no fees should ever be charged for public access to these proposed areas. So Spearfish Canyon Park, what is your take on it?
Well, the proposal that the governor has put forward can't move forward unless a bill moves through Congress first to allow the land exchange to happen. We did file a bill at his request, but I did not. I did not at the time know that there was such discussion last fall about people being unhappy about the proposal. So we have chosen in this Congress not to file that bill. I don't believe the swap should happen at this point in time until the public supports it and thinks that it is a good idea. Historically, the state takes better care of its land than the federal government does. I think there's millions and millions of neglected acres in this country that are regulated and owned by the federal government, and they do a terrible job of it. One of the reasons the pine beetles have been out of control in the Black Hills is because it's on Forest Service land, and they do no maintenance, no logging, no spraying, and it impacts all of those around it, private and state land, and causes us to lose a lot of our timber and forests and shelter for wildlife. So for me, you know, when you have the proposal and the swap was thinking about happening, I thought it was a potential way to preserve the canyon. To this date, has been extremely active on fighting the pine beetle. It has been a good resource. The state has done a good job, a good steward of taking care of state land. And so I assumed that the people of South Dakota were thrilled that the state would have control of that area rather than the federal government. But if the public is not supportive of it, it shouldn't happen. Hmm. And so that's what I have told the governor, is hold public meetings, talk to people, see if it's something that they want. If they don't want to do that, then this is not a bill that I'll be supporting out here in Washington, D.C.
I want to go back to tax reform a little bit. You and I have talked about that before, and you're calling this a once-in-a-generation opportunity here for tax reform. Let's talk a little bit more about that and dig into some of the things that the Ways and Means Committee in the House sort of talked about needs to happen right out of the gate after Inauguration Day.
Well, we haven't done tax reform in the United States for 25 to 30 years. So you're right. It is a once-in-a-generation opportunity. And in fact, all the other developed countries in the world have done tax reform since we have. And so now we have the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. It needs to be addressed because it makes us uncompetitive. Also, I think one thing that people don't understand about how we are hurting ourselves as Americans, hurting our economic growth, is when it comes to international tax reform. Right now, we tax everything that leaves the United States, and we don't tax items that are made and manufactured that come into the United States. we want to change that. We don't think we should tax things that are made in America. We should tax things that come into America and prioritize what we can create, build, put together, and manufacture here. So that's one of the changes that we're talking about making. It's called border adjustability. It's a territorial system. Many other countries are already on this system. We are living in the past by keeping ours the way that it is, and it's hurting our American companies, and it's hurting those who want to export and sell American goods around the world. So that's one of the changes, but also we're looking at individuals. We want to lower individual rates and simplify them. Right now we have 7 different rates. We want to simplify it down to 3, and we just want to make the code much, much easier for them. A handful of deductions, a standard deduction, a deduction for retirement saving, a deduction for education, a deduction for healthcare, but after that, you know, it would be a very simple process for you to pay your taxes because you wouldn't have to worry about all of the other. Also, charitable giving is one that we are including as well, that would be a deduction, because we truly do believe that is something that people want prioritized in the tax code. But beyond that, it would be a very simple process and much more fair, and it would make sure that people don't have to spend the $6 billion a year that they pay right now getting help paying their taxes. they spend a lot of money paying professionals because it's such a confusing tax code in order to do it correctly, and that's money they could keep in their pockets if it was simplified.
Are you optimistic about that? It does seem a little bit like the Holy Grail of a postcard tax, you know, filing your taxes and that simplistically. Do you think it can be done?
You know, it can be done. It's going to be very hard, or else we would have done it before now.
Right.
You know, there's already been many times people have said, well, I don't like this part. I don't like this part. I don't like this. You know, but that is, it's going to be hard, because when people view tax reform, they look at where they're at today. And they say, well, if where I'm at today and I go to that, and they look at that transition, they're not accounting for the growth. And people have really built their businesses, you know, using the tax code as you know, I'm going to organize my business. I'm either going to be a corporation or a partnership based on what my tax liability would be. You know, people may need to make decisions on their business based on how simplified the tax is going to be. So we believe that people will get on board recognizing the growth and the simplicity as a bonus, that in the future that'll allow for more growth and more people to turn those dollars over in the economy.
You're looking forward to Inauguration Day?
You know, I am. I've never been to an inauguration before. This will be my first one, and so it'll be an interesting crowd. You know, some things I don't look forward to. I'm not a big fan of big crowds and all the security, and of course it'll mean we're not in session that week, so it'll mean extra plane flights, which, you know, are always long in between South Dakota and D.C., but I'll be glad to be here. It's a historical moment in time, and I think I'll always be grateful to have been here to see and witness it and really be able to tell my children and grandchildren someday.
Kristi Noem, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate the generosity of your time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Laura. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Stay warm.